Berkowitz lived in a loop road just off North Broadway. He lived in an apartment building on Pine Street. He had a sister, who had two small children. Berkowitz was said to have shown real affection for these children. Berkowitz disliked dogs and had shot several, close to where he lived, killing some and wounding others. He said demons spoke to him through a large dog owned by a man called Samkar. They gave him instructions about the murders. Berkowitz had worked as a driver for the co-op cab company in the Bronx, before joining the postal service. He then lived in Co-op City, a middle-class residential area of the Bronx with slum houses nearby. He had joined the Baptist church near his home. A good description of Co-op City where Berkowitz had lived, Ron Kuko wrote in the margin of his transcript of this telephone conversation. Berkowitz was Jewish. Berkowitz was illegitimate, put up for adoption and eventually brought up by adoptive parents. He was regarded as a very solitary person with almost no close friends. He possessed Nazi symbols. There were other minor correspondences, such as correctly stating the killer had held numerous jobs in recent years. There were also plenty of inaccuracies, times when Terry was wide of the mark, as with her repeated suggestion that Son of Sam was somehow connected with a hospital. Dr. Rosa says all this is to be expected. No one has ever been known to produce only pure ESP information. It is always a blend of correct impressions, along with memories, fantasies and guesses. True statements do emerge in the rubble of trivialities and erroneous ideas that can mislead the investigator. In the Son of Sam case, Dr. Osas believes Terry Marmoreau produced enough correct information amongst the rubble, to demonstrate that real Psy was at work. Ex-detective Ron Kuko is more skeptical about the paranormal and the possibility of Psy being of much practical help in police work. But one incident, from the days with Dr. Osas and the psychics, sticks in his memory. Ron Kuko had called at the American Society for Psychical Research to talk to Dr. Osas, but found him engaged in an experiment with Dr. Alex Danlis, a psychic who was helping in the Son of Sam case. From a soundproofed, windowless cubicle some distance away from Dr. Osas in the control room, Dr. Danlis was attempting to project himself out of body into a laboratory where various electronic instruments would try to detect his presence. It was fascinating to watch, and Ron Kuko stood in the open doorway watching Dr. Osas. Over the intercom heard Dr. Danlis say, "Right, I'm leaving my body now. I'm coming along the corridor. Excuse me, Rodney." Ron Kuko politely stepped to one side. Then he realized what had happened. Dr. Danlis might have somehow known the detective was in the building, but how could he have known, from his windowless room, that Ron Kuko was blocking the way to the laboratory? The detective has never forgotten the incident. He also recalls, with a laugh, what it was like to work with Terry Marmoreau. Sometimes she would ring him at 2 o'clock in the morning to say Son of Sam was in a car cruising near Ron Kuko's home in the Bronx. The detective always dressed hurriedly and prowled the streets in his car. Ron Kuko has an open mind about psychics, but was always certain how much he wanted Son of Sam behind bars. No effort was ever too great. Today, David Berkowitz is safely behind bars, not very far into a 315-year prison sentence. But we may not have heard the last of the Son of Sam. The detective gave me a book, published in 1987. The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry, a respected investigative journalist, who claims Berkowitz did not act alone, but was part of a satanic cult known as The Process. The evidence persuaded Queens District Attorney, John J. Santasi, to reopen the Son of Sam case. Ron Kuko too takes the content of this book very seriously. At the time of the killings, Terry Marmoreau told the detective and Dr. Osas that Son of Sam was part of a satanic cult and was involved in devil worship and ritual murder. She even attempted to put names to some of Son of Sam's accomplices. If the truly was a cult, the Canadian psychic might have been even more accurate than she has been given credit for. So too might some of the other psychics. Chapter 3. A Casebook of Psychic Detectives. On the pure assumption that a few ESP subjects may, be able to develop conscious control of their ability, crime on any scale could hardly exist with its doak of invisibility thus removed. Graft, exploitation, and suppression could not continue if the dark plots of men were to be laid bare. Professor J. B. Rhine, psychics, seers, sensitives, mediums, call them what you will, have been around a long time. In the Bible, Joseph was a psychic who predicted famines for the Pharaoh of Egypt, and became wealthy and powerful by his visionary powers or psi. Today, such people occasionally help police with major crimes. Some have been credited with more success than Terry Marmorow had in the Son of Sam murder hunt. Their cases are worth study. If there is such a thing as second sight, some paranormal way of knowing, a dimension beyond the range of our normal senses, can these psychic detectives provide the evidence to prove it to the rest of us? Most people probably believe they have little or no psychic power. In the land of second sight, we are mostly blind. Not so, says Dr. Rosas, who agrees with Dr. Keith Harry, the judge in our successful remote viewing experiment, that we all have some psi powers. We just don't realize it. Dr. Rosas has worked on 30 major investigations in a 6-year study of psychics involved in solving serious crimes or finding lost aeroplanes. He says psi powers occur in everyday life as telepathic insights, something as simple as knowing who is on the telephone before you answer the call. In police work, a detective who follows a hunch or relies on instinct may be demonstrating psi. Amateur psychics sometimes triumph where professionals have failed. Dr. Rosas was once asked to help find a lost plane, presumed crashed, carrying businessmen from Bridgeport, Connecticut, to Albany, New York. Psychics scoured the scene from the air, one pinpointed a mountain, which was painstakingly searched, but nothing was ever found. Then an office worker, who believed he had some psi ability, predicted that in the autumn, the plane would be found, miles off course, between Bridgeville and Zora in northeast Massachusetts. That is exactly what happened. The wreckage became visible from the air 5 miles east of Bridgeville once the leaves were off the trees. Over the years, there have been many such claims of paranormal powers, and sometimes there are witnesses whose scientific standing and personal integrity are so widely acknowledged that it would be foolish to treat the case lightly. In November 1884, for example, one of the founding fathers of American psychology, Professor William James of Harvard University, stopped his open carriage at Shaker Bridge, a wooden structure over a river at Enfield, New Hampshire, where he witnessed a strange and dramatic scene. Standing on the bridge, staring at the dark surface of the river, was a middle-aged woman and a group of police officers. Suddenly the blackness of the water was broken by the head of a police diver, who surfaced, gasping for air. "Yes," he told the sheriff, "the girl is down there, trapped on the bottom, face down, arms spread." He looked at the woman and said, "The body is just how she said it would be." Professor James was watching the climax 2- or 3-day search for Bertha Hughes, a missing girl. 100 searchers had combed the banks of a lake, into which the river ran, without success. The woman on the bridge was Mrs. Titus, a psychic from Lebanon, 5 miles from Enfield. The previous night, in a dream, she had seen the girl's body under Shaker Bridge, floating face down. Below the surface, arms and legs spread-eagled, hair caught in branches on the river bottom. She hurried to Enfield, took the sheriff and his men to the bridge and pointed out where the body was to within an inch. The diver was particularly impressed. "Corpses in the water don't frighten me, but I feared the woman on the bridge. How can she come 5 miles and tell me where the body is? And it was in a deep hole, head downwards and in the dark, I could hardly see it." James wrote up his account in the very first volume of the Proceedings of the American Society for Psychical Research. Mrs. Titus had convinced him of the reality of psychic phenomena and set him off on a lifetime of research, including his famous investigation of the American medium Mrs. Leonore Piper. Of course, if all psychics managed to hit the jackpot the way Mrs. Titus did on Shaker Bridge, the debate about psi might have long since ended in their favor. The fact is, Many get it wrong, and even psychics who make correct predictions can also produce reams of incorrect information. Skeptics might say Mrs. Titus was an eccentric who had a dream that coincidentally turned out to be true. Against that, there have been many others like Mrs. Titus. In general, psychics are called in by police as a desperate last resort in the investigation of serious crime where conventional methods are not getting results, like the Son of Sam case. On the other hand, it is also true that psychics, although not called in regularly, are used more often than the public is told. If a medium helps locate a body or murder weapon, the police avoid courtroom complications by saying simply that acting upon information received they recovered the weapon or found the body. Prosecutors and policemen don't encourage the belief that unorthodox methods of detection are used. In court, the evidence of a psychic might be open to challenge and could even be inadmissible. There have been famous psi detectives in recent times, and Dr. Rosas has worked with several. His favorite was the Dutchman Gerard Kruijzer, who died in 1980 at the age of 71, and was perhaps the most celebrated of all. Shy and not well educated, Kruijzer was brought up at Inschoten, Holland. He showed some clairvoyant ability as a child, but his talent could not earn him a living in his early years. He was a bankrupt ex-grocer, aged 36, married with a family, when he was discovered in 1946 by two eminent parapsychologists, Professor W. H. Seetenhove of the University of Utrecht, Holland, and Professor Hans Bender of the University of Freiburg, Germany. Tenhoff did several months of psi tests on Kruijzer in Utrecht and said he was one of the most remarkable subjects he had met. A notable career was about to take off. He recommended Kruijzer to the Dutch police, who tentatively used him to trace missing children and catch minor criminals. He was soon invited to help solve major crimes like murder. One of Kruijzer's early successes was at Weerden, Holland. This was a case of a girl who had been savagely attacked at night and beaten unconscious with blows from a hammer. Kruijzer never met the victim but was given the hammer to hold. He grasped the handle and said the man who struck the blows was aged about 30, tall and dark, with a deformed ear. He said the hammer belonged to an older man, living in an old cottage frequently visited by the attacker. This was almost Kruijzer's first major case, and no one took him too seriously. On the say-so of an unknown psychic, no real search was launched for a man with a deformed ear. It was too melodramatic to be true. Months later, police arrested a 29-year-old man on a different charge. An alert policeman noticed his deformed left ear and recalled Kruijzer's description of the assailant in the unsolved hammer case. Under questioning, the suspect admitted attacking the girl with a hammer, taken from the cottage of an older friend. Exactly as the psychic had said, Kruijzer gained initial fame for locating missing persons. He was once consulted by telephone about a lost child, and predicted her body would be found in a canal near Eindhoven in 3 days' time. 3 days later the girl's body was fished from the Eindhoven canal. Dr. Rosa said some of Kruijzer's greatest successes were over the telephone, just like Terry Marmorow. An American academic was given proof of Kruijzer's long-distance ESP. Dr. Walter Sandelius, professor of political science at the University of Kansas, telephoned Kruijzer in Holland. He was concerned about his daughter who had disappeared from a hospital in Topeka, Kansas, a week earlier. From thousands of miles away, the psychic correctly described the hospital grounds and said the girl had left there, hitching lifts in a car and lorry. She was now in a city, looking at boats bobbing on the water, and would return home in 6 days. She was safe and well. 6 days later, the impatient professor was making another call to Holland, when his daughter walked through the front door. She had hitched rides, as described by Kruijzer, and 6 days earlier had been watching boats bobbing on the ocean at Corpus Christi, Texas. In the early 1960s, Kruijzer, already a celebrity, was brought to America to try to catch the Boston Strangler. He attended a meeting at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, New York, with Dr. Osis and Lieutenant Cronin of the Bureau of Missing Persons. Dr. Osis recalls, Croizet was trying to impress us with his philosophy, which was just watered down Spinoza. Then he said to the policeman, "You have some interesting objects in your briefcase." Croizet said the documents in the case involved state security, part of a very recent crime, the murder of an important man. The policeman was astonished. He had just come from Central Park, where a professor of physics at Columbia University had been shot dead. The professor had been working on a secret project for the government, and bloodstained papers, scattered on the ground from his open briefcase, were labeled top secret. U.S. intelligence agencies were already fearful of KGB involvement and a spy scandal. Croizet was asked to assist this murder hunt. He said jealousy was a possible motive, and he spoke of the professor's involved social life. He described in great detail a restaurant in New York, where the physicist might have met his murderer. The restaurant sounded European and very unusual, with archways and a courtyard. A skeptical Lieutenant Cronin, born and raised in New York, said he was sure there was no such restaurant in the city. Croizet, unperturbed, set off in a police car, on a tour which ended precisely at the restaurant as described. This turned out to be a regular rendezvous for the physicist and some of his friends. The psychic seemed to be picking up lots of leads and gave a dramatic account of the dead professor's personal life, including the idea that he might have been held prisoner at an address in New York, before escaping. It all came to nothing. There were suspects, but Croizet's snippets of information, sometimes startlingly accurate, did not pinpoint a killer. Then, 2 years later, two black youths, arrested for something else, confessed that they had shot the professor for money. It was a straightforward mugging. Dr. Rosa says this is typical of the problems faced in working with psychics. Much of the information is imagination and only a certain percentage is pure clairvoyance. Croizet had some real insights into the life of the professor, but they had not been relevant to finding his killers. The psychic had led police along a false trail. Croizet was not regarded as a professional psychic. He never demanded a fee for police work, usually he even paid his own traveling expenses, but he charged for private consultations, and ran a spiritual healing clinic to support his family. Being a psychic detective was almost a sideline. He gained a reputation for being able to see the future by a series of experiments known as chair tests. Chairs were numbered around a table for a conference, and Croizet would write a description of the person he thought would occupy each chair in a few days' time. Seating arrangements were always random. His notes were sealed in envelopes to be opened after guests had seated themselves in any chair that took their fancy. Croizet's descriptions were read aloud, and Professor Tenth said the psychic was often remarkably accurate. Precautions were taken to make sure the notes in the envelope were not tampered with, nor the seating arrangements rigged. Croizet made his predictions at times varying from 1 hour to 26 days before a meeting. In one successful test, Croizet wrote, "I see nothing." This was for one chair out of 30 which ended up vacant because a guest failed to turn up. He once predicted a chair would be taken by a woman with a scarred face. The woman who sat down had facial injuries from a car crash a few months earlier. Sometimes, Croizet's notes included information about a person's past, present or future, and were said to be uncannily accurate. But chair tests were not always successful. They worked in Holland, Austria, Italy and Switzerland, but in New York the experiment flopped. Croizet's descriptions matched only a handful of cases. Witnesses said the psychic was undismayed and spent a long time trying to work out what had gone wrong. Perhaps it is that psi cannot be turned on and off like a light switch, even by the acknowledged best in the world. Some psychics, of course, claim complete control over their ability. Dr. Rosa says the celebrated psychic Eileen Garrett scoffed when asked what states were favorable to psi. "I can sit on the George Washington Bridge and do it," she said, referring to the busiest bridge in New York. Dr. Ozus observed that her performance could vary from excellent and ill, depending on health, mood, motivation and state of consciousness, as well as compatibility with those she was reading or working with, a long list of variables. Several other well-known psychics have worked with police in fairly recent times, and no list would be complete without Peter Herkos, another Dutchman, born in Dordrecht in 1911. He was a merchant seaman at the outbreak of the Second World War, and joined the resistance movement against the Nazis. In 1941, working as a house painter, he fell from a ladder and woke up in hospital. The bump on the head seemingly caused him to develop clairvoyant powers, which nevertheless failed to prevent him being arrested by the Germans. He was liberated by American and Canadian troops from Buchenwald concentration camp at the end of the war. In post-war Holland, his new sixth sense brought him local fame. He could locate missing people, describe what had happened to them, usually by holding some personal item, the skill known as psychometry. Herkos never claimed spiritual motivation. He demonstrated ESP on stage and on television, and accepted money for what he did, with one exception: he never asked to be paid for helping the police. He was brought to America in 1956 by millionaire Henry Belk, owner of a chain of department stores. Apart from getting the psychic's advice on business matters, Belk used him as a clairvoyant store detective, to uncover embezzlement and large-scale theft. Belk said this was all part of a program to test the range of the psychic's gifts, but the partnership ended in tragedy and acrimony, according to the written accounts of Herkos's career. Belk's 10-year-old daughter disappeared from the family home in North Carolina, so he telephoned Herkos in Miami to ask for help. Herkos promised to call back. Minutes later he rang and said Belk's daughter had drowned in a river near the family home. The body would be found near a clump of bushes. It is said Belk went to the river and found the body of his dead child. It was the end of his relationship with Herkos. Belk said, if he could see the future, why couldn't he tell me what was going to happen in time to save her? In Miami in 1958, Herkos was credited with a key role in bringing a double murderer to justice. The head of Miami Homicide Department, Lieutenant Tom Leip, called Herkos to the murder of taxi driver Edward Center, found shot in his cab. Herkos sat in the cab and put his sixth sense to work. He described the killer and is said to have told police that a few hours before the slaying, the killer had shot another man in the Keys area of the city. Checks were made and officers found there had been another shooting earlier. John T. Stewart, a retired naval commander, had been shot dead at his home in Key Largo. Herkos linked the two killings before police thought they were connected and gave a clear picture of the killer: tall and thin, walks like a sailor, has a tattoo on his right arm, has been in trouble with the police and is known in Havana and Detroit. He was called Smitty. The police cross-checked with their colleagues in Michigan and found a merchant seaman and ex-convict, well known in Detroit. His name was Charles Smith, nicknamed Smitty. A photograph of Smith was wired to Miami and shown around the murder district. A waitress said it was a man who boasted one night of killing two men. She hadn't believed him at the time. Eventually, Charles Smith was sentenced to life imprisonment for double murder. Partly as a result of publicity from this case, Herkos was asked to help find the Boston Strangler by the Deputy Attorney General for Massachusetts, John Bottomley. As with the other psychics in the hunt for the Strangler, Herkos was not totally successful. He always acknowledged that at least a fifth of what he saw would be either irrelevant or inaccurate, an underestimate, according to Dr. Ozus. In the Strangler case, Herkos surprised police with his insights about suspects. Eventually, he led police to a man with a pointed nose and a scar on the right-hand side of his face. For a moment this man was thought to be the Boston Strangler, but later, the real killer turned out to be another man, Albert DeSalvo, who also had a pointed nose and a scar on the right side of his face. DeSalvo confessed to the crimes, but was found through normal police work, not through the psychic powers of Peter Herkos or any of the other psi detectives. Like other psychics, Kirkus was often criticized for confusing police with wrong or misleading information, but his work was also praised by senior policemen in major investigations. Inspector Jack Hall, working on the Jackson murders in Virginia in 1960, said Kirkus led police to two different suspects, either of whom could have been the killer. Kirkus also astonished the police chief with a flow of personal information about his family. He knew all about Hall's bad back, and the death of Hall's son from leukemia. He predicted, to the day, when Mrs. Hall would give birth to a child, the 24th of June 1961. Hall said, "It was enough to make you believe in Almighty God." The policeman gave Kirkus credit for helping to establish which of the two suspects was the real killer. Dr. Osis has always conceded that Psy, in its practical application to police investigations, is a blend of correct impressions, memories, fantasies and guesses. He also knows there are many scientists who say the evidence for Psy is anecdotal and deals with the activities of charlatans and cooks. But over the years, so many of these anecdotes have been attested by eminent men and women. Were they really all deceived? Dr. Osis told me how psychics are normally used in police investigations. Usually they visit the site of a murder or abduction. They are often taken to explore a search area, to try and locate a victim's body or the wreckage of a plane, or to trace the escape route of a criminal as he flees the scene. Two of the psychics Dr. Osis worked with, the late Dr. Alex Stannis and Beverly Yeager, are said to have led police directly to corpses. More often, says Dr. Osis, the psychic can provide only a few clues, previously unknown details of the murder, characteristics of the getaway car, or perhaps information about where the killer lives. A psychic may tune into the killer, but mostly there is so much going on at the scene of a murder or plane crash that he becomes confused. The psy practitioner on these occasions is exposed to a great amount of sensory input, some of which can be distracting. The small voice of ESP may be drowned in the noise of ordinary perception, says Osis. On site, psychics often cannot work at their own pace. Driving along a road, trying to sense the getaway route, they may be forced into snap decisions about where to turn, because of traffic or the impatience of a skeptical police driver. With most psychics, accurate impressions occur in spurts, often fragmented, and with large gaps. If the questioner is impatient or aggressive, the spontaneous flow can turn into storytelling. Getting the best out of a psychic is a skilled business. Dr. Osis has seen opportunities wasted because of police skepticism. I have watched officers who first of all must test the psychic. They spend an hour having the psychic prove himself or herself by giving information that is already known. The psy practitioner will oblige, some enjoy impressing people. They may describe the victim, his house, the murder scene, in such detail the officers are delighted, they think this is great. But I am dismayed. I know the peak time for Psy has passed, and nothing valuable will be produced concerning the real target, the unknown aspects of the crime. Today, most scientists and policemen have little faith in psychic detectives. Perhaps skepticism would be diminished if scientists, working with psychics, could devise a way of detecting when information truly comes from the inner eye of Psy, and is not a guess or fantasy. Is there some subtle variation in speech rhythm, skin temperature or brainwave measurement waiting to be identified as the hallmark of real Psy? Osis is doubtful. He believes a laboratory setting, where psychics are wired up to machines which monitor them, is usually counterproductive. Repetitive laboratory procedures diminish Psy, which occurs spontaneously in some people in response to real-life situations. Dr. Osis has plenty of experience of such experiments. One of the psychics on the Son of Sam case was Dr. Alex Stannis, a medical doctor with whom Osis closely worked for many years until Stannis died in 1990. Stannis was the man who held the bullets from the Son of Sam victim and produced a sketch of a killer. His preferred method of working was to go out of body to the scene of a crime and describe what he saw. He often did this from Dr. Osis's research laboratory at the ASPR. This was a soundproofed cubicle, where he was wired up to an electroencephalograph, EEG, machine to measure electrical changes in his brain as he attained an altered state of consciousness. To test the validity of Dr. Danis's claims, Dr. Osas would ask him to move out of body from the cubicle into another room, 5 doors away down a corridor,